Welcome to a Friday, and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. So glad you've tuned in today with former state legislator Jessen Farrell, now working on public policy at the Civic Ventures Think Tank. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amy Radel, KUOW reporter, currently working on our Burning Question series, What Would a Climate-Friendly Seattle Look Like? Hi, Amy.
Hi there.
Chris Vance, former King County Council member, state legislator, Republican Party chair, former Republican.
Mm-hmm. That's it. That's all of them.
Welcome. We'll talk about all that kind of stuff. First, we want to talk about some of the big news this week, locally, nationally. First of all, you might love the jobs and the money and the people and the building that Amazon has helped attract to Seattle. You may resent all of it. Either way, we won't be alone for long. This week, Amazon listed 20 cities it might choose to put its second headquarters. Toronto, Columbus, Indianapolis, Chicago, Denver, Nashville, Los Angeles, Dallas, Austin, Boston, New York City, Newark, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Montgomery County, Maryland, Washington, D.C., Raleigh, North Carolina, Northern Virginia, Atlanta, and Miami. Now, Chris Vance, you say Seattle liberals are being reminded that capitalism means competition with those cities.
Yeah, and that's a fact, like it or not. I mean, capitalism is competition, and corporations are going to go where they can make more money. Business is amoral. You know, and money finds its own level, kind of like water. And this is a very old story in the Seattle area. I remember for years, one Boeing CEO after another standing up in front of the chamber meetings or the Rotary meetings and giving speeches about how if you don't do something to fix your business climate, we're going to leave. And they've partially left. You know, they're building planes in South Carolina, still building planes here, of course, and moved their corporate headquarters. And Washington has the highest unemployment taxes in the nation, the highest L&I rates in the nation. Our environmental regulations are some of the strictest in the nation. The minimum wage is the highest in the nation now. And all of these things together make it very expensive to do business in Washington State.
Which of those things would you change?
Right. Well, that's the two things the business community will focus, and it gets less attention than it should, is reforms to the L&I system.
Labor and industries.
Yeah, and unemployment taxes. But they let there's
what's the change? What should change?
To make perhaps find more options for businesses on how they provide their unemployment, their workers' compensation issues, to basically just lower the unemployment rates. But the bottom line is we haven't done those things. We're not going to do those things. And there's consequences for that. Now, it's not the end of the world. Amazon's not leaving completely, but they're just not going to expand as much here as perhaps they would have if Washington was a more business-friendly state.
Reporter Amy Radel, didn't Amazon cite other factors, like just wanting to diversify beyond Seattle and other reasons besides L&I and unemployment?
Yeah, I don't feel like they've given a lot of background about their thinking. I mean, I'm wondering why Seattle even tried to bid for the second headquarters, considering, you know, once they've announced this national competition, it would have been pretty surprising if they had said, oh, yeah, you're right. We just love it here. We don't need to leave. So they're going to looks like a getaway from the West Coast, looking at a lot of these contestants.
Yeah, nothing but Los Angeles on the list of cities. Jessen Farrell, what do you get from this list of 20 cities? I'd like to do it again, by the way. I'd love to read it
that
again. Thanks. But
it's a long list.
Yeah, it's a
lot of numbers, a lot of things to read on the radio. Well, I would first of all just say that as far as the business climate goes, Seattle is booming, and Amazon is dedicated to the city. 2 million square feet of new office space coming online, 3,000 openings, job openings. So I think that I would disagree with Chris's point around the climate. Cities are great places to do business, and I think Seattle exemplifies it with its, you know, really humming economy. I think the other side of this, though, is that the other part of the story, I think, though, is about the triumph of cities as a place to do business. You have companies like Weyerhaeuser that originally located outside the city, now locate in the city. You have a lot of businesses, Outer Ring Chicago at one time, you know, was home to suburban office parks and now are relocating in the city. That's because you have transportation networks, you have the ability to attract talent, you have transportation. Those are the things that companies want, and Seattle has that. But clearly, Amazon has massive growth needs, 50,000 additional employees.
Chris, if Seattle's so bad for business, why did Amazon choose to grow here so much? Why Weyerhaeuser coming in?
And like I said, this isn't the end of the world. You don't want to overstate this case. I think, as in most things in politics, people on both sides go way too far. You hear Republicans talking about how this is the worst place in the world to do business. It's not. There's Seattle has a lot of advantages. It's a great place to live. We have access to a great university. It's access to a lot of tech workers and a highly educated workforce. So Seattle is a great place for a lot of places to locate. But it is still true that, especially if you're looking for manufacturing, that it is an expensive place to do business. And so when we get into competition with some of these other places, especially places like right-to-work states, we're at a disadvantage. And that's just a fact.
And I'd say so then that may be a Boeing story, but that clearly isn't the story around Amazon.
Competition is competition. And I don't know. No one knows exactly why Amazon's done what they're doing. But the bottom line is, just like Boeing, a big Seattle company now is going to start expanding elsewhere.
Do you think Amazon, does anyone here think Amazon will get tax breaks and subsidies in another city that Seattle will match to keep them here in HQ1?
No. I mean, the first part of your question is yes. I think other cities and other regions are much more willing to do whatever it takes to bring the jobs here. And here, you know, that immediately gets attacked as, oh, you're selling out to big evil corporations. So the first part of your question, I think, probably is yes, they will probably get these tax breaks. And second, no, Seattle probably won't try and match them.
They won't at right now, you know, but that always becomes this leverage that can play out over time when things aren't as rosy here. Then, you know, they can play off against each other. And then Seattle might feel pressure to eventually match something like that.
Again, though, what is it that is the point of corporate taxes? To be able to invest in education, transportation, all of those things that corporations ultimately need to be able to be successful in a region.
Will Amazon eventually move to a city or cities that that give it a better deal? Amazon is in Seattle at the very high level to stay. They have balls here. They have glass spheres here. Is it permanent, or is there any danger of, you're saying you don't want to say the sky is falling?
Look, I mean, I'm not a corporate CEO. I haven't chosen to have a career in the corporate world, but we need to be realistic about how this works. Amazon's a corporation. They have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders. They will, like any corporation, do what is necessary for their bottom line. And you know, who knows what's going to be best for their bottom line 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now. My main point just, however, is unfortunately, like it or not, capitalism is competition. And Seattle and Washington State handicaps itself through some of our policies.
A Week in Review listener named Greg wants to know if anyone thinks Jeff Bezos will keep living here or move his family to this other location, because that's the best indication of a commitment to a city. He says, follow the kids. Follow the wife and kids, because he'll have homes all over the place. But what's his main residence?
I have never met Jeff Bezos. I have absolutely no idea.
Also this week in the news, Seattle member of Congress Pramila Jayapal said she's not going to attend President Trump's State of the Union address to Congress on January 30th. She told KOW why she's staying away.
When he disrespects people so deeply, I do not think that he deserves to expect that we will participate in the State of the Union. I still vote on every bill, and I still make sure that I carry out my responsibilities. But to ask me to be in a room with a person who has called people who come in on the family immigration system the worst of the worst is absolutely unacceptable, and I won't do it.
Chris Vance, you have left the Republican Party to start a new centrist movement, saying, quote, the American people are sick and tired of the gridlock. People are divided ideologically and can't talk with each other. What do you think about Seattle's member of Congress staying away from the State of the Union address?
Well, I assume later we're going to talk about the looming shutdown tonight, and that's where this comes into play, is Republicans and Democrats just can't work with each other. But on the subject of Donald Trump individually and personally, I'm with Congresswoman Jayapal. I don't think we should do anything to legitimize this president until he begins to act like a legitimate president.
But isn't attending the State of the Union legitimizing the State of the Union?
Anything, I think, to communicate. Congress needs to be doing a whole lot more. I mean, look, he needs to act like a legitimate president. He needs to release his taxes. He needs to start following the Constitution in regards to the Emoluments Clause. There's a story on the wire right now that people who are bidding to buy one of his properties in India are being promised the right to meet with Donald Trump. He's using the White House as a profit center. Congress needs to be holding him accountable to that. So anything to express the fact that his presidency is outrageous, I'm for.
Former Washington State Democratic Representative Justin Farrell, if you had Jayapal's job, would you attend the State of the Union?
I think Congresswoman Jayapal is absolutely justified in the stance she's taking. I think that Chris has really laid it out very eloquently that these are not normal times. This is not a normal president who is not acting in a respectful way towards large swaths of the American population. And we need to be standing up using all the different ways that we have. And as a congresswoman, that is something that she can be doing, refusing to attend the State of the Union address. I absolutely think that this is something that I would do. And I really commend Congresswoman Jayapal for, in no uncertain terms, saying why she won't attend.
But every precedent we break raises the question of how that might be reinstated or not when we have a different president someday. And I can imagine Republicans under a Democratic president in several years, if that happens, saying, well, we're going to sit out the State of the Union and it's all just going to crumble. It's not going to retreat back to a, you know, more traditional atmosphere.
And that's a good point. And one of the most unfortunate things, I think, is that both sides have demonized past presidents. I mean, I disagreed with Barack Obama. But he was a qualified, intelligent, obviously someone who's qualified to be president. Democrat disagreed with President Reagan, President Bush. But again, these are people who had been governors, had been serious statesmen. They might disagree with them, but they're honorable people. Donald Trump is completely different than every other president we've ever elected in the history of this republic. He's acting completely differently. And in this one case with this one current occupant of the White House, I think you need to stand up and say this is just wrong. And I think if we continue to treat him like a legitimate president, then we are going to get more like this. I mean, you can see more people thinking this is how politics should be, you know, conducted.
Because people who disagree still come to the State of the Union address and sit down and listen. For example, do you want the State of the Union to be a speech, Jessen, where a president just speaks to his or her allies?
A president should absolutely use the State of the Union as an opportunity to lay out a policy agenda that may be in sharp contrast to the opposition party. But Donald Trump has used his position of power to disrespect people, to disrespect our neighbors and our community members, in a way that really needs to be stood up to. And again, I think, and not only is it just around disrespect, he's abusing power, his constitutional obligations, fiduciary duty. In all different ways, he is undermining the American experiment of democracy through his disrespect for institutions, disrespect for the Constitution, disrespect for the press. And so these are unusual times that call for unusual statements against what he is doing.
I think Congress should go much farther than just boycott. They should shut Washington, D.C. down until we're not going to do any business, and Mr. President, until you release your taxes. Just start there and immediately stop using the Trump Organization and its ties to the White House to make money for yourself. Respect the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. Begin there and apologize for the comments you've made to virtually half the world. Those things, I think Congress needs to, under the Constitution, the only body that can check the president is Congress. They need to do that.
Amy, are you suggesting that whatever anybody thinks of President Trump, that you could imagine a presidency, pro-life members of Congress skip the State of the Union of a president who supports a woman's right to choose, a member of Congress who thinks the Iraq war was a counterproductive slaughter and that drone strikes are a war crime. Maybe they should have boycotted President Obama's State of the Union. That's human lives at stake. Is that where we're headed?
I think, yeah, that seems to be, and I completely understand the cases that you guys are making and, you know, and her decision to stay away. It's just what's going to happen with the next administration. I think that we're kind of setting precedents that aren't going to be retreated from necessarily.
I think that we are capable of avoiding the slippery slope argument. For example, as a legislator, a Republican called me publicly to all of my colleagues a baby killer. But I chose not to make a big deal about that because he apologized to me, for example. And there was a much deeper culture of respect around working together that exists in Olympia. It was a one-off, unusual circumstance. This president obviously has run ships slipshod across many different structures and norms, and we need to stand up to that.
You mentioned a government shutdown coming. Do you think that'll happen tonight at midnight, Chris?
It appears extremely likely right now. I mean, they're just starting to see stories on the wire about the results of this meeting between Trump and Schumer, but it appears extremely likely that they don't have the votes in the Senate to pass anything. And
the House has passed a continuing resolution to keep the government funded for another month or so.
Yes, and so that's the fourth continuing resolution. They still can't pass a spending plan. Look, this is illustrative of the fact that our entire system is breaking down. I mean, I hate to be so negative, but our entire federal system is breaking down. The system is predicated on the assumption that, it was designed with the assumption there wouldn't be political parties, but that with our bicameral legislature and a president with a veto power and the Senate having the ability to filibuster, that the two parties will work together to get things done. If that doesn't happen, the system doesn't work. And the Republicans and Democrats in Washington, D.C. right now can't agree with each other on anything. And it's been that way for years. The last government shutdown was about Obamacare. This one's about immigration. The Republicans want to deport people who've been here for a very long time and have put down roots. And the Democrats are standing up against that, and neither side is willing to compromise, and so they're going to shut down the government over it. The gridlock in Washington, D.C. right now is just impenetrable.
Anybody see any hope?
Well, I would add a nuance to that around the story of this is the fact that no one can compromise anymore. I would argue that when you are in charge and there is one party rule in Washington, D.C. right now, it's your job to get the work done. That is certainly what I learned as a House Democrat.
But the Republicans don't have 60 votes in the Senate. They have to work with the Democrats to get anything through the Senate.
Well,
there really isn't one party rule.
Well, on the fact of a budget, you know, rule number one that I learned as a freshman Democrat in the House was when you're in the majority, you pass the budget. You may not like the compromises that come with that. You may not like some of the things that come out of it. But rule number one, your constitutional obligation as a legislator in the majority is to get the budget passed. And you get your votes from your own party. You do not have to rely on the other party to get the work done.
But Representative Farrell, in the House in which you and I served, the majority could do that. In the United States Senate, they cannot pass an appropriations bill. An appropriations bill is subject to filibuster. If the other side chooses to filibuster, you need 60 votes. The Republicans don't have close to 60 votes. So the Democrats are partially to blame here because neither side can work with each other.
And again,
in D.C., that must happen.
I would argue that as the majority party, then, it is your job to figure out how to get those 60 votes. And that happens in bonds, for example, in the Washington State Legislature, when just did it last night.
Right.
You had a majority party in the House and the Senate craft a package where you were able to get 60 votes or whatever the number of votes was on the Senate side. Sorry about that. But that's the idea, that when you're in the majority, you set the tone, you set the table. And the Republicans are setting the debate in a way that there is no way to get to yes.
Amy Radel, do you have colleagues who are involved in this lawsuit with the media trying to get legislators, Republican and Democrat, to disclose their calendars and their text messages? You know about this?
Yeah, absolutely. We have Northwest News Network. So that's Austin Jenkins and Tom Bonzi and people that are on our air all the time. Their group is part of this lawsuit, along with a lot of media organizations. And it sounds like they won a victory this morning.
Yeah, this is news from this morning. A Superior Court judge in Olympia ruled that Washington state lawmakers have to publicly disclose these records. Reporters wanted to see lawmakers' daily calendars, texts, documentation of any staff complaints against House and Senate members. The legislature refused, arguing that the disclosure rules that apply to other elected officials and agencies do not apply to them. And a coalition of media groups sued the state. And today, that Superior Court judge sided with the media. How important do you think this morning's ruling is in this case, and what might happen next?
Obviously, for the journalists, it's good news, and I'll let the legislators weigh in on how that would have affected their work if they were subject to these disclosure requirements. But I think the transparency, you know, they talked about the representative who voluntarily gave over his calendar, and you know, we had a sense of what kind of lobbyists he was meeting with and things like that. You know, that's really obviously important information for the public. And I email with people all the time, and we all know that our emails are subject to public disclosure, and we are very professional. And yeah,
remember that when you're emailing, you never see an email from a colleague and you think, that person just forgot that this is not their email and not their computer.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, people, you know, kind of act a little too fast sometimes. But I think especially when I'm emailing, you know, public officials, and mm-hmm. we are, you know, we're all like super aware, and it's just, you know, I always imagine that all my email could be public because people forward things all the time. So that's present in my mind anyway, but I'll let you guys talk about how that would affect your work.
Yeah, well, we have two former state legislators, Jess and Farrell. State lawmakers work for the public. We own their computers and calendars and work-related texts, don't we? Why is this a contentious issue?
So I would say that I broadly agree with that legislators should be disclosing their calendars, what they're doing. I think that absolutely is in the public interest to know who I would be meeting with, what I might be saying to them. I think that absolutely matters. And the other thing I think is...
So why are lawmakers withholding that information?
Well, I think that's a good question. I really don't know, because I think we're also in an era where we should assume that every single thing we submit electronically is possibly going to be in the public realm anyway, in light of various hacking scandals and other things like that. So in some ways, it's... our attitude is a little archaic. On the other hand, what I would say is that when you're deep in negotiations on a sensitive issue, there does have to be a deep degree of confidentiality, because you have to have trust. You have to be able to try out some ideas. You have to be able to...
But why can't we all learn how the sausage is made? Yeah, this is the people who work for us trying out ideas. And if it becomes public, it's public.
Well, what if the idea is... you know, not fully thought out, and it's politically difficult. I mean, sometimes we want our politicians to do tough stuff, right? And so you need a little space to think through those things. But I think that you can do that and still fully comply with public disclosure laws. And I think that it is very reasonable that public disclosure laws apply to the legislature.
Chris Vance, do you have anything to add about why legislators are arguing that they shouldn't be held to the same disclosure rules as other state agencies?
Well, Jessen just nailed it. And that's it. You know, they have these frank conversations about political things on their email, and they don't want that disclosed. But there's no logical or legal reason why the legislature shouldn't be subject to everything that every other public employee in the state is subject to. So this is inevitably going to happen. I think we need to worry about, though, is every public agency now is being deluged with requests for public records, and you literally have public employees who do nothing but compile emails and respond to these requests that are often just harassment.
It's so easy to request,
yeah,
to officially
yes.
request those records.
The day I announced for the United States Senate, the National Democratic Senatorial Committee requested every email I had ever done, from when I was a county council member, when I was a legislator, when I worked for the superintendent of public instruction. And so, a bunch of public employees had to spend hundreds of hours compiling my emails for no good reason other than politics.
Did every email you've ever sent for over decades?
Yes.
Really?
Everyone they could get their hands on. And that's common nowadays. If you're a citizen and you're mad about some decision somebody makes, you request everything. And I think we need to deal with that. The other thing, though, is the legislature... unless we want to go to a full-time, year-round legislature, the legislature does need to be exempt from certain things, such as the Open Public Meetings Act. Because if you have to – when I was on the county council, if 500 people signed up to testify in a law, we had to sit and listen to 500 people testify. They don't do that in Olympia. If they were forced to do that, we could not have a part-time legislature. So we need to be – I think the legislature in some ways needs to be treated differently, but not on this.
I'm going to put Amy's excellent question to you, and then maybe Amy will want to follow up. But I think your question, Amy, was how would this disclosure requirement affect your work? Okay, so whether you like it or not, your difficult proposals might be public, let's say. So then that affects your constituents how?
Well, what I would say is my assumption was that everything I was putting in writing was potentially public anyway. I think it was... for the reasons I stated,
yeah,
that we're in an era where things get hacked, where things can get forwarded. And so anything that I was emailing it was with that mindset, and frankly, that it should be public. I mean, I just want to make it really clear that I actually agree with this, that what we do should be public. At the same time, it just underscores the tension between having everything disclosable and the need to be able to have trust and have a conversation when there may not be an example is you may have a conversation with a Republican colleague, say, and then you need to go shop it back to your Democratic colleagues and see if you could get the votes on it. If something like that becomes public too soon, it may be dead on arrival because you didn't get a chance to lay the ground with your other colleagues. So
does this mean more face-to-face meetings to kind of throw things out, because that's the safest way to...
Yeah, and I don't know that necessarily changes the practice in Olympia anyway. So
until we have video cameras on legislators at all times, and that's public record too. Anything you say is our business.
I'm so old that when I was in the House, we didn't have email. But when I was in the county council, we did, and we understood that anything we put in writing was subject to being requested. And so when I needed to talk to a colleague, I'd go walk down the hall and talk to them, you know, and negotiate on a piece of legislation, not put it in an email. So they can learn to work with this. It's not that big a deal.
Body cams.
Yeah. I mean, the spirit of it is the same, right? What you write in an email and what you say in a back room is equally the public's business, right? Theoretically.
No.
No?
No. Politicians do need to have the ability to at least have conversations among themselves that aren't in front of the cameras and the public at all times. Otherwise, you will never get agreements.
Yeah, the tension is the public wants you guys to achieve things too, and so you need to have some abilities to do that, I would think. So,
but at the same time, we are talking about public records and the importance of public records. Who are you meeting with? What are the studies that you're relying on to make a decision about something? What is the data behind those studies? And just as we want the public to have access to those from our agencies, I think the same could be said for legislators. That's really informative to understand what it is that what kinds of records legislators are themselves creating and relying upon.
This is The Week in Review. That's Jessen Farrell. She was a state legislator. Chris Vance was a state legislator and lots of other kinds of legislators and used to be a Republican. Amy Radel, still a reporter at KUOW, and we're all digesting the week's news, and we're going to come back and continue that in just a moment. This is KUOW's Week in Review with our panel, Jessen Farrell, Amy Radel, Chris Vance. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. We're on Twitter now, at KUOW. The TV star and stand-up comedian Aziz Ansari is kind of a liberal darling. He calls himself a feminist. Here's a bit of his stand-up act.
I really feel like all guys of this generation is kind of a sad state of affairs. Like, gentlemen are gone. We just have dudes. I get so bummed out when I talk to my friends that are like single females. When you talk to them about what they're looking for, it's such a sad conversation. They're just like, you know, just someone nice and clean. That's pretty much all they're looking for. The bar is so low right now. Like, if you're a nice dude and you're clean, like you brush, shower, use deodorant every day, you're in the top 1%. You can pretty much anybody, I promise. Just be nice and clean. Women will take notice. Don't try to act cool. Just be nice and clean. Women will notice. They'll be like, what? 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 You just held the door open for me and you're wearing pants? Come on, let's go. Let's go! I haven't seen a dude in not cargo shorts in 3 years.
This week, a website called Babe ran a woman's account of her date with Aziz Ansari. The woman doesn't use her real name, calls herself Grace, and describes in detail how she and Ansari met, set up a date, went to dinner, came to his home, how he repeatedly, sometimes physically, tried to get her to agree to sex. Grace called it sexual assault. Some prominent female writers in prominent publications have suggested that the Me Too movement's gone too far, that Aziz Ansari did not deserve to have this printed, especially by an anonymous accuser. In the New York Times, writer Barry Weiss said women are not powerless. A person in Grace's position should, quote, use a four-letter word, stand up on her two legs, and walk out his door. And here's author Caitlin Flanagan, who wrote a piece in The Atlantic headlined The Humiliation of Aziz Ansari.
I mean, when I look at young women, I'm in my 50s, they've accomplished so much that is just, I mean, women my age just sit back in awe, you know, their goals for careers, the kinds of careers they go into, their fight to be paid equally to men, It's breathtaking. But then in this one core area, they're so weak, which is they jump into these, you know, hookup situations. I have zero moralistic comment on that. And then they become terrified to say the thing that we were taught right away. Don't kiss me if I don't want to be kissed. I absolutely refuse. I'm walking out of here. And for someone who's like the Ansiz Ansari in this situation was putting up zero threatening behavior towards her, she said no exactly one time, and his response was, let's put our clothes on. You know, he did put her hand in his crotch a bunch of times, which is certainly wrong. But it's to be exposed this way, I think, is crazy.
Okay, so there's a couple of issues there. Should Grace have felt physically threatened? I think a lot, maybe most women, feel they could be physically overpowered and hurt by the man they're with. Number two is the idea that women are socialized to be deferential. This kept coming up this week when we discussed this. Seattle writer Katie Anthony, who blogs at Katie, Katie, Kate, told me that even when her child's teacher does something inappropriate, she's afraid to challenge that teacher.
My heart races. I get very uncomfortable. I get scared that someone's going to get mad at me. And it seems like a small thing when I say I get scared that someone's going to get mad at me, but it is a muzzling force and it's completely internal. And it has been given to me by my entire life of watching people say nothing and text the next day, or smile and go along in order to save feelings. And so the idea of speaking up at the moment feels impossible. It feels like it's hard to even envision. But as a parent, I force myself to do this because my kids are more important than my comfort. And I think, you know, people who don't necessarily have kids, people who are dating and finding themselves in these situations, have to find something about themselves that they value that much to be able to say, like, I'm going to challenge myself to know even before going into this, what am I willing to take? What am I willing to do? And I am willing to walk out.
Finally, Seattle writer Erica C. Barnett of the C is for Crank talked about this. She says, I am an outspoken feminist. I argue, I talk back. And she said, even I defer to men.
I find myself doing this in life all the time. I step aside for men. I, you know, try to cover up for their gaps in knowledge when we're in meetings. I let people talk over me. And part of that is because, you know, I was trained practically since birth to always prioritize men's comfort over my own. And men know that.
Former state lawmaker Justin Farrell, you and I have talked about sexual assault in Olympia. What's your reaction to the Ansiz Ansari publication and this discussion about saying hell no and the socialization of women?
Well, I'd like to make two points. And the first one is really about turning this conversation on its head. So far, all of the focus has been on women. Should this woman have come out and disclosed this date? How do women feel in this situation? What if we turn the spotlight right on Ansiz Ansari and said, instead, you're a public figure. You have a public persona that is based on this sensitive critique of modern dating, and yet you're a jerk when you go out on a date. And you think that wasn't going to come out? So that's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, to keep the spotlight on him, what cultural signals was he getting to, again, make it think that it was okay to be pushy, coercive, regardless of whether you call this assault? And I read, you know, the account, there were lots of moments that were coercive, pushy, suggesting having more alcohol to get the consent that maybe he wanted, et cetera, et cetera. So why aren't we putting the spotlight on him and his behavior on an experience that I think way too many women this resonated with, this particular kind of push, coerce, kind of intimidating behavior on a date?
You said you wanted to highlight those social signals that men get, right?
Yeah.
What are those social signals?
One would be the lack of sex education in schools. What are we teaching our kids as a counter to what they are seeing in the media, on TV, in pornography, et cetera? There's a real dearth of that kind of conversation. What are we saying? Again, a lot of this conversation was about her. She should have, you know, to use old fashioned terms, taken her handbag and slapped him across the face when he got fresh with her, right? Well, what should a man be doing to get to a place where we're talking about mutual pleasure and consent? That conversation isn't happening at all. And finally, what I would say is a lot of the critique was, well, she wasn't using her power in that moment. She used her power. She went ahead and spoke out about this, and look at the backlash.
True,
and
that is her power.
She went ahead and spoke out, and this is a conversation that we need to be having.
Well, let's start then with sex ed in schools. So kids would talk about consent more than they do in schools, not just here's the mechanics.
I think we should absolutely be talking about consent. I think we should be talking about intimacy and what it means to have mutual pleasure. I think that there are a whole set of behaviors that we do not have mechanisms in our culture for talking about.
Chris, you're a parent. Does that sound right?
This entire subject makes me incredibly uncomfortable because
not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, because I think and operate in my career in the area of public policy. You know, and sexual assault and sexual harassment and rape are illegal. We don't need more laws about that. Well, actually, that's not true. We can always make improvements to laws. This is the kind of thing that the discussions about culture that get very emotional in our society. But, you know, people say we need to have a conversation about it. Okay, we can have a conversation. What does it lead to? I mean, what do you want me to do about this? I mean, I've tried to raise my kids to not act that way. And I've tried to raise my daughter to not tolerate that. I'm not sure what else, you know, we can do. It is good. Everybody's talking about this. But, again, it's the kind of cultural issue that makes me uncomfortable because it then kind of slops over into politics somehow.
One thing that surprises me about the timing is in December, the New York Times had this huge, amazing piece about the women who work for Ford. And there was kind of, I thought we were kind of going down this road of saying, okay, now we're going to broaden this whole discussion into more like working class women, poor women, what's happening in terms of sexual harassment, sexual assault in the workplace. And so we seemed poised for that. And now suddenly we've kind of veered back into the media and Hollywood world. I'm not saying it's not an important discussion as well, but I'm sorry if it comes at the cost of retreating from, I mean, those stories were incredible of what those women have been through, even having a powerful company and a powerful union and everything. So I hope that that still stays as part of this discussion.
I think that we are capable of advancing this conversation on all of the different fronts that it is coming up in, whether it is in the workplace. There are very clear lines around what is and is not sexual harassment, and we need to make sure that we are doing the work, not just in the white collar setting, but in places like hotels for hotel workers, in factories where there may be women who are very, very worried about speaking up. So that's one thing. But I do think that the conversation that has come up around the Aziz Ansari case is around intimacy, around coercion. But it is also, I think, very much in the cultural aesthetic of Me Too, which is if you are using coercion, pushiness, intimidation to get what you want at the cost of someone else, then it's time to speak up.
So in Olympia right now, there's a few things that are being debated. Number one, we have one of the shortest statutes of limitations in the nation on these sorts of crimes.
Felony sex offenses.
Yes.
And they're considering reducing that.
We're considering
increasing the statute of limitations.
So let's give people more time to come forward.
Yeah.
There are thousands of rape kits that go untested every year. There's legislation to speed that up. There are things we can do to let victims understand that if you come forward, you'll be listened to and respected. And when you talk about the workplace, you know, we should need to be vigilant about that. But the problem, when you start talking about people in a dating atmosphere, what should have happened under the law is if she felt that she was assaulted, she should have filed a police report. I mean, that's how our system has to work. The system can't protect you if you don't file a complaint, and there'll be an investigation and prosecution if that's justified.
And I think one of the things that has come out so poignantly is that the system just does not work.
No disagreement.
And I would add to that, and this is really where we lay bare deep cultural divides. I would argue we do need sex ed in schools that addresses consent and intimacy and mutuality in addition to the mechanics and the biological aspects of that. And we don't do that. And I think that there is not a place for a counter narrative. I think the schools would be a good place for that. against the cultural signals that many boys and girls are getting through media and movies and the internet, et cetera.
We have a program called Radioactive where we work with high school students, and that's been enlightening to me because we had some students talking about sex ed in their school district outside of Seattle, and it was very different. And it was kind of the same guy who had had a spiel for years, and he would come in every year, and he talked about fair maidens and town sluts and how you want to be a fair maiden. And it was really outdated stuff, and it's happened, you know. And so I think one of the best things parents can do is just find out what the curriculum is and what are the guest speakers and things that your school's doing around sex ed, because the lesson to me from their project was it really varies.
Yeah, the curriculum, that's exactly right. I worked for 8 years at OSPI. The curriculum on this is very much
Superintendent of Public Instruction
is very much locally driven. And then also for parents who are worried, like, I don't, you know, don't teach values to my kid, I will teach them that, which I respect. It's voluntary. Parents can opt their kids out of sex ed. But these types of curriculums can be, and I think probably are to some degree, being developed at the local level.
So, Jessen, you said that we can have multiple conversations at one time, but I talked to several women earlier this week who did want to talk about the socialization of women to defer to men, but I hear you saying, wrong conversation, just talk about Aziz Ansari and men.
I wouldn't characterize it as the wrong conversation. I was being deliberately provocative and saying, well, let's talk about him. Let's put the spotlight on the man's behavior instead of just on the women's behavior. It's not that we shouldn't be looking at how women are socialized to accommodate and to not speak up in these cases. That is absolutely something we should be talking about. But I only highlight the fact that so much of the conversation has been about the woman who came forward, not about his behavior, mm-hmm. and not critiquing what it was both in him personally and in our culture that says it's okay to act that way.
What about the so-called cultural conservative point of view? Is it gaslighting? Is it misdirecting to say, you know, if men and women would wait to know each other before they take their clothes off instead of on the first date, you're more likely to treat each other better than Aziz Ansari did here, and more likely to be clear to your partner about what you want.
And typically historically, that then becomes the woman's job to be the keeper of all of those things. And I think that's where the real problem is. There's nothing wrong with saying, you know, trust and intimacy are really important ingredients in a sexual relationship. But I think the problem becomes that we often say, and the women are the ones who need to be in charge of that part.
And this is what I mean. This is the slippery slope that I hate, because the point you made is what conservatives and what the world I used to occupy is always talking. Our culture is sick. People are too permissive. You know, you can have sex on demand now and get an abortion, and you can get contraceptives, and we need to go back to when we – and, you know, that leads to bad legislation. It leads to big political fights. I think we as Americans have just got to get to a point where we actually respect the idea that we believe in liberty. And liberty means letting each other live our lives as we choose and stop telling each other how we need to act and what your morality ought to be, and leave that, you know, to the culture and to families and to individuals instead of trying to legislate on it. Because these conversations always seem to end up with some sort of legislation.
Yes, conversations do lead to legislation sometimes. This is Chris Vance and Amy Radel and Jessen Farrell. We're going to take a break, and we'll talk about the liberty to do what you want as it wafts over to the nose of somebody in a King County park, and maybe talk about what's going on in Olympia, a world all of you know well. The legislature is underway. So Chris is enthusiastic. That's enthusiastic consent to talk about Olympia yeah. coming up on the Week in Review. This is the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Could be the end of the road for smoking in parks in King County. You know, Seattle already banned smoking in its parks. Now the King County Board of Health is looking at a ban on smoking and vaping at county parks and rec sites. And get this, the Board of Health Chair, Rod Dembowski, says this is about more than secondhand smoke.
It's really about children and children observing the use of tobacco. This discussion really started around tobacco use in our professional sports stadiums here. Studies have shown that children and young people observing professional sports players using tobacco can be an on-ramp to use. That discussion prompted further inquiries by me about, well, what are we doing in all of our parks?
Athletes using tobacco, we're talking about chew?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which doesn't waft into my nose. But how did we get to smoking in King County parks?
From that?
Yeah.
Well, what Rod is saying is that kids go to the park and they see adults smoking, and so they're more inclined to smoke. I think that's what he's pointing to. A couple of things really quick is there are very few county parks left. As the King County has turned over all the parks to the cities, there are very few county parks left. But I'm totally fine with this. My mom died of emphysema. My mother-in-law died of lung cancer. I hate cigarettes. They are one of the bane of our public health system. And people should have the right to go to a park and not breathe secondhand smoke. Simple.
But since Dombowski brought up the idea of having the right to go to a park and not see something that you don't want your kids to see, is that a good reason for the legislation?
That's a fine reason. It's a lesser reason to me. It's more simply, I don't want to go to a park, and I don't want to go to any public place that I'm paying through for my taxes and be forced to breathe in secondhand smoke.
I think there are a whole host of issues around tobacco use that have kind of been swept under the rug in some ways. I think we often think, well, that's an issue that we've taken care of. We've banned smoking in public places and restaurants, et cetera. But we do know that tobacco use is on the rise with young people. And so I think that we need to make sure that not only are we doing measures like this, but really the prevention work that needs to get done. And I think that, you know, county health budgets are under deep duress. And so we need to be looking at how are we making sure that county health departments have the resources that they need to be doing the prevention and, you know, the health work across the board.
Amy, do you want your kids to never see another person smoke?
Well, I kind of think of the poor parent who might want to be at the playground with their kids and maybe they vape and they want to, you know, so it's, and also they talk about, you know, does this disproportionately affect the homeless? But I guess that's really a question of enforcement rather than just kind of having a voluntary guideline for people in the parks.
Let's talk about what's happening in Olympia. We have a couple of former lawmakers here. We have a brand new Democratic majority in the House and Senate. And what's the most important thing happening in this legislative session so far?
By far. Last night they passed the capital budget. The state of Washington passes three budgets, operating budget, the transportation budget, and the capital construction budget, which funds buildings like just around the corner here at the University of Washington. For the first time in state history last year, they didn't pass a capital budget. They were locked. Republicans and Democrats were locked in a battle over something else, which was water rights.
Is it passed this time because Democrats have
No, they made because way in the weeds here, but they still needed some Republican votes to sell the bonds, to finance the capital budget. They reached an agreement on the Hearst decision on water rights. Amazing, right? Republicans and Democrats actually sat down, negotiated a deal, and because of that, they passed the capital budget. And because that was the one issue that they absolutely had to do this session, so I guarantee you they're going to get done in like 58 days. There will not be a special session.
Amy, you were asking about the blue wall.
Well, yeah, I just wondered if when Monica Dingra was elected, there was all this talk by the Democrats of this is going to become, you know, we're going to see a lot of climate change legislation and things like that as Washington takes its place on the West Coast. So I'm just curious what you guys think about the prospects for that.
Well, I think what you are seeing is the results of the fact that there's Democratic control. You have the Equal Pay Act, Representative Sen's bill that just passed in the House. You had the Voting Rights Act that passed in the Senate. So a lot of these major policy efforts that have been really held back by divided control over the last 5 years, we are going to see pass. And I would also add and just echo Chris's point that getting the capital budget done was a major step forward, and the Hearst decision and getting a bill passed around that, you know, liquors for drinking, waters for fighting, that was a really tough and sticky issue. And it goes again back to the point I was making earlier, which is the majority was dedicated to putting things on the table that would get to those yes votes. And we do not see that happening in Washington, D.C.
Right.
If the Republicans in Congress came to the table in the same way we would have different outcomes nationally. Oh, we just don't see that there.
You're 100% right. The Democrats were willing to work with the Republicans and give them part of what they wanted in terms of water rights. And because of that, they got a deal on the Capitol budget. That's what does not happen in Washington, D.C. But, you know, if you're a progressive, there's other things happening in this session. I think last night the Senate passed a bill on banning conversion therapy, so-called conversion therapy regarding homosexuals, and gun rights legislation. I think they're also taking a real run at banning the death penalty this year. So I don't know how much of this agenda they're going to get done, but the Democrats are moving a pretty aggressive agenda.
I want to tell you one more story before we close out the Week in Review. You know, Hawaii was working on its safety drills when this worker released the wrong selection on the drop-down menu, and our colleague KOW reporter Ann Dornfeld was on vacation and got that text message: incoming missile, not a drill. She tried to remember where she had seen a concrete building. She remembered a Whole Foods looked concrete. So she and her husband are driving around their rental car with their 3-year-old kid, wondering if they're doing the right thing.
How many minutes does it take for a missile to hit Hawaii from North Korea?
Yeah,
I have no idea. 4 minutes? 40 minutes? You know, like, are we stupid for still being on the road right now? Should we just run into someone's carport? And there was a guy who leaned out his car window as he was driving past us and yelled, "Goodbye, everybody," which kind of enraged me. But
was that supposed to be a joke?
Yeah, I think he was trying to make his last hurrah was being funny. I don't know. Yeah. I wasn't amused.
Last hurrah of humor, find a Whole Foods. What would you do if you got that text message at breakfast?
Hide, get underneath something, do all the old-fashioned things, because if you are within like 3 miles of a nuclear blast, you pretty much have no chance. But if you're farther away than that, you can survive it if you do the old things they taught people to do back in the 1950s. It's interesting. In Olympia, they're actually debating on this because we're within range of Korean missiles too, possibly.
Yeah. Final moments?
I guess I would get out and mobilize to make sure that we have a different president in 2020. And that
that's what you would do with your last minutes of
Earth.
Right.
Well, heck, what else are you going to do?
Right.
Yeah, our shower stall is pretty small, but I think we just try to pack ourselves in because, as Chris said, you know, I have been reading more about this lately in these fears and wanting to learn what you can do. So,
by the way, did you see the screenshot of the drop-down menu? Mm-hmm. It's very familiar to any of us who've had an IT department, and it was not easy for that employee to choose between BMD false alarm, one-dot test message, PATCOM CDW state only drill, PATCOM CDW. That's the gobbledygook. And you got a scare, and then you got your life back. So that was nice. That's all for today. Jessen Farrell, former state lawmaker, now at the Civic Ventures Think Tank. KUOW reporter Amy Radel, former Republican Chris Vance, and I'm Bill Radke. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for tuning in.